No prize for guessing what the startup ecosystem of the US is known as. Of course, Silicon Valley. But that's because a major chunk of the country's entrepreneurs are housed out of the Silicon Valley, which is a region in the southern part of the San Francisco Bay Area in Northern California. But what would you call the startup ecosystem of India? Definitely not Bangalore Valley. Well, as much as Bangalore is known to be a hub of innovative minds, startups reside in every nook and corner of India, which as a nation rests its shoulder on the terminology called Jugaad. This certainly needs to be a more inclusive term, and what better than Indus Valley. Hello and welcome to Money Control. This is Priyanka Sahai and you are tuned into Setting Sail, our weekly podcast that dives through the changing landscape of the entrepreneurship ecosystem and the challenges within. And today we have with us the man himself who coined this terminology for the Indian startup ecosystem, Sachit Pai, Director of Bloom Ventures. Hi Sachit, thank you so much for taking time out for us.
Hi Priyanka, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Absolutely, that's a pleasure Sachit. So let me begin by asking you about this whole concept of Indus Valley that you have coined. You've written a 7,000 word or article on why India can be called, the Indian startup ecosystem can be called Indus Valley. Why don't you begin by actually telling me how did you derive to this name? What was the whole idea behind that?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the Indian startup ecosystem is now in its fourth decade. And especially over the last, I would say, 5 to 7 years, it's become a very confident, evolved startup ecosystem. And parts of it, I would say, are almost akin to startup ecosystems in the most developed countries. I mean, you really can't differentiate between the kind of founders we have here, the way in the business models that are getting built. So we are not really second to anyone in that sense. Of course, Silicon Valley or China is a little more evolved and, they have far more differentiated business models. To that extent, India is just catching up a little bit, but I don't think we're second to none. And I was fascinated by how this entire ecosystem has evolved and how, and as I was interacting with startups and founders, I found that there are interesting differentiated playbooks and approaches that are kind of getting created. And for example, cash on delivery. Cash on delivery is a very unique Indian innovation that's got created to address the problem of payment systems not being evolved. But on the other hand, you also have UPI, which is one of the most evolved kind of payment stacks in the world. So I found India a fascinating one with all of these differentiated business models, playbooks, approaches. And I felt it was time to kind of coin a term for these set of approaches and business models. And that was how I came up with the Indus Valley playbook. And I wanted a kind of a term for and thought Indus Valley captured it well. So that's really how it kind of evolved, that India is a very mature, entirely mature, but it is fast maturing market, startup ecosystem now. And I felt that was time to kind of give it its due.
A long due terminology that Indian startup ecosystem gets with it. Now, you've also mentioned about Jugaad or the Dekhi Jaegi attitude, Hatspah attitude that India has. How does that work in the country's favor, if it does?
Yeah. So I think Jugaad to me is, I would say, a good word for that is indigenous, like our own unique way of coming up with low cost solutions or very innovative approaches. And that's kind of been studied, the books written on it, etc. But to me, if there is an attitude, the equivalent of Jugaad, if Jugaad is how India natively is, the startup economy's equivalent of Jugaad is Dekhi Jaegi. Because, for example, take a company like, for example, Ola. When Ola started up, or even Uber in India, which kind of is a startup end of the day, it's very difficult to wait for the regulations to come in, which kind of favor you. Sometimes the regulations are unclear. So you need to kind of take that chance and really build. Flipkart, for example, every few months, every few weeks, sometimes regulations change. And then the corporate structures have to be fairly complicated to kind of evolve. Indian entrepreneurs who succeed have kind of got a sense that, look, if you wait for the government to kind of give you everything clear cut, it's not going to happen. It's better if the opportunity is there to expand And while they're not committing any crime, they're really taking advantage of the gray area and saying, let's just go out and ask for apologies instead of permission. So this is this attitude of Dekhi Jayegi. And I think it's a uniquely wonderful attitude. And I think some of the best founders, especially in like, you know, slightly regulated areas, have this wonderful attitude of Dekhi Jayegi. So get built. We'll see what happens. So that's to me. Yeah.
Absolutely. And very, very beautifully, you just put up that Dekhi Jayegi. There's nothing negative about Dekhi Jayegi, because technology will always be ahead of regulation. And I remember Amitabh Kant has said this on multiple occasions, like, you know, even when the whole regulatory hassle started for the cab industry, because the cab industry, now we do have the definition of aggregation. But around those days, especially in the year 2015-16, a lot of ambiguity existed. We did not have a clarity on how these aggregators and under which policy can these aggregators come. Because there was no policy for aggregation as a model. And the Motors Vehicle Act perhaps could not include them because they were not the ones who were owning the motors. So very, very rightfully you pointed out that the Dekhi Jayegi attitude, if you don't have that, startups cannot like thrive in an ecosystem.
Absolutely. You said it. Yeah.
Now, you know, having said that, the whole never-ending comparison that India has with its neighboring nation, which is China, despite China being way ahead in terms of venture capital funding, or I would say they've proven themselves in terms of technological innovations, product development, to a much, much larger level. But the comparison keeps on happening that if China did this 2 years ago, India is well placed. How do you see this comparison? And would you agree if I were to tell you that this is more like an apples and oranges comparison? And these are two different markets.
No, I would agree with you. It's not just apples and oranges, Priyanka. I think it's like more like extreme watermelons and like, you know, oranges or something. So China is evolved well ahead of India. Just to give you an extreme example, if you take the e-commerce market, the Indian e-commerce market, e-tailing market, that is goods we purchase, not services, goods we purchased largely, was a $38 billion market in India. It's about 5% of overall retail. China, it kind of more than a trillion. That's the size of, it's about $1.2 trillion last year. It's about a quarter of the 5 trillion retail market. So 25%. But due to COVID, they say it's close to 50% now. So it's incredible how China has been able to kind of grow, and the comparison. And I could give you many industries. Education is about the only one where I feel like India will have a better chance of catching up. It's a good comparison. It's good for us to benchmark and learn, try and benchmark and learn. But you are absolutely right. I think it's, you can call it apples or oranges. You can call it watermelons or apples. It's a country that's good to learn from, but it's also a very, very different and evolved playbook, I feel. That's a very unique Chinese playbook as well, which succeeds there.
It's quite an evolved playbook, to say the least. And having said that, let me also point out that India for long has been known as a copycat model of the startups world. We see that a lot of the successful startups, if I may call them, or unicorns of the world, which India has, are actually the copy cats of the companies that have been successful abroad. Why do you think India has still not been able to become the product innovator? Why is it that they're only residing about the on the proven model? Why are we as a nation not yet emerging out and coming up with our own ideas and own products, and I mean letting the world see what is in store for them?
Okay, it's a good question. I think nations or even startup ecosystems go through phases, right? So as you develop through the world, typically what happens is that there are proven models which have worked, like for example in the US. So there are, for example, folks who sell movie tickets online. And so it's logical to think that, if it sells well in the US and it's something that's worked, why can't it succeed in India? So and funding also is sometimes de-risked a little bit easier. So fundamentally, as an ecosystem takes shape, that the risk-taking ability is a little lower. So you typically are comforted by if this model exists outside, etc. But that said, I think we are also kind of reaching in certain kind of, I would say, Meesho, for example. It's a good example of a very uniquely Indian innovation, which doesn't easily exist anywhere else. Of course, you can say group, so selling social commerce exists outside. People sell to their friends like Tupperware. Sure, in that sense, yes, maybe it's a little more similar to Tupperware. But using the internet, using WhatsApp to sell, for example, doesn't exist, you know, in too many other markets. So as we go forward, we'll start seeing uniquely Indian companies which take advantage of Indian context, Indian situations, like Dunzo is a good example. Smallcase, for example, is a very unique financial innovation which doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. So we are beginning to see the first wave of very brave Indian startup companies. Not too many exist. So I would say Meesho and Smallcase are very unique, maybe Dunzo are unique examples of Indian unique products. But we'll start seeing more and more of these coming. Just give it some time, I would say. All startup ecosystems go through this phase of copying what's worked in the West or copying what's worked in the developed country. But we are beginning to see very confident founders. We are beginning to see, it's sort of like the Indian cricket team, right? The fearless young, young cricketers. And so there are fearless young founders who don't know what's gone before. So they're creating their own unique products. And I'm very confident that we will get out of this copycat structure very, very soon. Yeah.
That sounds quite promising. But let me also ask you that here, I would say founders are not the only ones who are under the question. I would say that even the investors, by and large, I would say that some amount of responsibility lies on their shoulders as well, because at the end of the day, you yourself said that it's a very comfortable zone. So it's a low risk area. So most of the people would come and want to, park their investments, park their money in these proven models. But what will it take Indian investors to actually go all over, put up their money, place a large amount of risk, and then see if it flourishes or not?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Yes, investors can't entirely absolve themselves. Yes, investors do like models that have worked in the West. They are comforted by the fact, no doubt about it. That's it. What gives me comfort, Priyanka, and what is likely to happen is we're beginning to see a fairly interesting and I would say extensive early stage ecosystem emerge, led by founders, operators. So a lot of the early stage checks now are coming out of founders. Like, for example, there's the Flipkart Mafia, especially, Kunal Bahl of Snapdeal. He runs Titan Capital. They're beginning to back these founders. And the first set of checks that are going out are exactly like Silicon Valley. Over a coffee, they're saying they're meeting and then just cutting checks. 4 to 5 crores can easily come to high quality founders through that. And then there are funds such as Bloom, we're sitting to kind of back some of these, the next stage. So till us and maybe the next stage, Series A, there's enough capital that is coming to back crazy ideas, irrational, bizarre ideas. We are very happy to kind of back crazily ambitious ideas. Now, beyond that, the Series B checks all come when you're proven repeatable revenue models that they want to know that if you put X amount of money, X plus one will come out of it. That stage, not too many companies reach that stage. And so what happens is if more and more companies reach that stage, you will start seeing more and more capital come. So I would say the big capital can only come if we start seeing more and more of these crazy audacious experiments hit scale. Thus far, many of these crazily audacious ideas only emerged in the last 1 to 2 years. You'll start seeing, like Khatabook is a fascinating example of a crazy idea which doesn't exist anywhere. It's again, like I would put it on the league of a Meesho or a Smallcase. It's a very unique product, which as it has grown and as it's kind of like really scaled, you've seen more and more capital come into it. So I would say it's the success of these audacious experiments which will convince big money to kind of back it. So I would say that at the very early stage, at the seed stage, we're beginning to see lots of bets. VCs are taking risks. But the big money from the Series B onwards can only come when they start to succeed. And we have to see the startup succeed and scale fast. The moment they scale, we'll kind of start putting more money behind it.
That sounds promising. And we hope that more and more investments flow in this direction going forward. Now, you mentioned a terminology called forcing function in your article.
Yeah.
What exactly does that mean? And which all sector would it apply to?
So forcing function is sort of a way to kind of describe constraints that force you to take a certain behavior. Like, for example, like an elevator, for example. So the elevator's door will only open if it squares up with the floor. If it is in between, the elevator's door won't open unless, like, you know, there's an emergency or something. So forcing functions is a design terminology. I kind of adopted it to describe the constraints that the Indian economy is facing. And there are about five forcing functions I identified, which kind of set the context in which Indian startups operate. And I can describe those forcing functions. But for example, one forcing function is that we are fundamentally a poor country, where per capita income is $2,000. That said, we have a small but slowly growing consuming class, and it's not even fast growing, it's a slowly growing consumer class of super affluent Indians. And so you start seeing very interesting patterns in the Indian economy where for example, the cheapest milk will also, people will drink it out of the cow, and then there'll be like the most milk, which is priced at some 150 rupees per liter, also sells. So India is a unique market, and these different forcing functions, the fact that we are a low per capita country with an evolved consuming class, the fact that we have a very high quality tech workforce, which can speak very good English, and we have like the world's third largest English population, and very strong link with Silicon Valley. So all of these create very interesting pulls and pushes for Indian startups. So I described about five forcing functions. We can go deeper into them. And these forcing functions, they're not specific to a sector, but these forcing functions are specific to the economy. And these forcing functions are sort of like gravitational pulls. And they pretty much govern the way in which the startups operated.
India, by and large, have always been spoken about in terms of its population. Globally, it's said that with such large population comes a large market size. But how true is that exactly? I've spoken to a lot of second-time entrepreneurs, the entrepreneurs who perhaps have tested water, who sold their first ventures and started afresh. Now, a lot of these people have always told me that the wealth lies in the 1% of the population of the country. And perhaps that is the market that they are trying to target to, because they are the only ones who have the purchasing power. So two questions there, Sachin. How true is that argument? And then what is this whole talk about, the next 100 million consumers coming from tier 2 and 3 cities? How is that even possible?
Sure. So I think those founders who said that much of the consumption base is the top 1% are right. So I like to look at India in terms of pyramid. And at the apex of the pyramid is what I call India 1. Which is really people like us. And actually, there's an even narrower segment of that called India 1A, but we'll leave it at India 1. So India 1 is about 100 million people. And it's not 1%, but maybe it's a little bit around, it's about 10% of the country. But yes, there is a 1% as well. But about 10% of the country forms the active internet consuming base. They're the people who shop online. They're the people who kind of have any money. And I call this India 1. And roughly, if India's per capita income is around $2,000, India 1's per capita income is around $9,000. So once you, and it's about a trillion dollar economy. Once you take them away, then I look at India 2, which is another 100 million people, which is, for example, the people who have come about the internet thanks to Jio. So there are our drivers, our mates, etc. Okay, or like really aspiring people, and they typically have a per capita income of not of 9,000 or anything like that, but of something like 3,000. And then finally, there is India 3, which is really poor people who are not a target market. So I would say about India 1 is 100 million, India 2 is 100 million, and India 3 is about 1 billion plus. And I would say that the real story of startup is that thus far, a lot of the consumption is driven by India 1. But the hope is that a lot of the consumption can, you know, India 2 will emerge to consume. And when I say India 1 and India 2, it doesn't mean that India 1 is only in metros and India 2 is in smaller towns. No. Every large city also has India 1, India 2, India 3. Like Delhi has people like us who are in India 1. There are people who stay in the poorer parts of the city, etc., who are aspiring, who are security guards, who are, for example, working as blue-collar Swiggy drivers, riders, etc. So they're India 2. And then there are beggars or really poor slum dwellers. That's India 3. Similarly, a Meerut will have India 1, 2, but in a much smaller proportion. For example, a Vodafone executive or a government servant in Meerut will be in India 1. And this is a good framework to kind of understand startups. So you have India 1 startups, for example, as Zomato or a Book My Show, are all started as an India 1 kind of play. But they're slowly expanding to see if they can tap India 2 for growth. Because India 1 is like maxed out. There are very few startups which have succeeded in India 1 and India 2. Flipkart could be one of them. Paytm could be one of them, etc. India 2 is an interesting opportunity. But the challenge is, and we're beginning to see India 2 startups emerge. Whether it's, you know, ShareChat is a good example of that. Chingari, Khata Book also could be a good, interesting example of that. But the challenge is India 2 doesn't have the kind of income to support monetization. And that's one challenge we'll have to kind of solve. So this is, I would say the founder that you spoke with about 1% is absolutely right. And so a startup like Cred is trying to kind of just address that top 1%. And some of the startups are saying we'll address that top 1% and then it'll go global. That's a good idea too. But many of the startups today are saying, look, I'll target India 1 and then I'll kind of expand to India 2 if possibly, because that's how I get large scale. So these are some of the kind of playbooks that are emerging, and I can double click on this if you would like me to. Yeah.
No, that's quite explanatory. But, you know, Sachit, having said that, I would only want to ask you that this whole claims of the next $100 million customers coming from the smaller towns, and mm-hmm. most of these claims have been made by the e-commerce companies, especially during their festive sales that, you know, the tier 2, 3 cities are emerging to be the next buyers. How true is that when they don't even have enough disposable income? And I completely buy your argument of tier 1, 2 and 3 residing across the country. But my question is again focusing on the tier 2 population staying in the smaller towns and areas.
Correct. So Priyanka, my finding, my research, my inquiries, I've spoken to startup founders, executives, researchers. They all tell me that unfortunately in India, we are not seeing large number of paying customers emerge from India 2 or tier 2 population. Mm-hmm. Yes, due to COVID, we have seen an increase in tier 2 cities spending. But the tier 2 cities, the people who are spending are that 1% of those cities.
Absolutely.
So typically what happened is many of them came on the internet to purchase phones or electronics, which is typically the first thing that they buy online. So first thing they buy online is tickets, railway tickets, travel. Then the first goods that they buy online is phone. Okay. Because 40% of phones sold in India are sold online. Okay. Maybe a little bit more than 40% also. So after that, they don't buy for shop. They don't buy clothing or groceries or anything. They just once in a while, they may buy a toy or something. What happened due to COVID was many of those people who had done some purchase online, like a phone, like online ticket, they said, let us try shopping. And Myntra and all did see a lot of sale coming from tier 2 cities, I admit. But they were all the top 1% of the tier two cities. So that is the point I think I want to say. So a lot of people got excited by saying, oh, tier two cities, a lot of saying Indian e-commerce is expanding. No, it didn't expand. What happened is the elite, the 1% or the 2% started spending more. So a lot of the growth of the $27 to $38 billion that $38 billion of e-tailing spent this year and $27 billion last year, the bulk of the $11 billion increase delta has come more from the consumption basket of the rich increasing and not so much new people entering and spending.
Right. You just I would say hit the nail. And all we can do is just hope that slowly and steadily, as the economy improves, perhaps that'll be when the overall consumption pattern of the smaller towns and people, like you say, India 2 and 3 also evolving. But that's not going to happen anytime soon is what I think.
Sadly, I kind of concur with you. I think you're right. COVID certainly impacted their incomes. A lot of the people have lost jobs. There's been uncertainty as well. Many of them have got jobs back also, but they're a little uncertain because they suddenly lost a job. 3 months they had nothing. Now they're coming back. So they're a bit shaken. And it'll take some time for them to get confidence, etc. And until then, unfortunately, it's people like us who have to bear the burden or carry the flag of spending to keep the economy going. Yeah.
Right. Now, you know, something very interesting you pointed out in your article, which is that India's startup ecosystem is much more strongly plugged into Silicon Valley than that of Japan or Germany.
Correct.
Now, can you elaborate a little more on that? You've spoken about brain drain, how India has higher education infrastructure, but is that still a lot of cream is flying out of the country and, you know, setting up the bases out of Silicon Valley? How does that work?
So it has been very fortunate in the sense that sadly, but fortunately, due to the colonialization, we've grown up with good English skills, the elite of the country. And I feel about 130 million Indians speak good English, about 10% of India speak good English, speak okay English. About 20% of that, like people like you and me, speak very good English, which is on par with anyone in the West reasonably. So what that does is that, and because of our technical prowess, we have about 700 to 800,000 Indians who graduate from engineering, of which about 10%, I would say, are reasonably good engineers. So 70,000 to 80,000 are really good engineers, plus add another 25 to 30,000 liberal arts and other graduates. So about 100,000 Indians who graduate are good English speaking and can work anywhere in the West. And reasonable percentage of that, I think about 15% of that, have been traveling abroad for their higher studies. And over time, there's been a strong kind of bridge that's emerged between the US, East Coast and West Coast, especially the West Coast, and India. They graduated out of the IITs, NITs, IIITs, and then or even good engineering colleges like BITS and go and kind of live in the US. They work. There are a lot of Indians in Silicon Valley. So it's very easy to go to Silicon Valley. There are a lot of investors there, who are Indians, there are a lot of product guys and technical guys who are Indian. So it becomes very easy to kind of interact, get into the right thing. So over time, the flows have kind of deepened. And interestingly, now you're seeing Silicon Valley executives, product guys, investors, or even operators, founders, invest in Indian startups. So I would say that thanks to English, thanks to our over-evolved, for a poor country, we have extraordinarily good education institutions. Very rarely do you find like a country of $2,000 per capita. If you go to Turkey, for example, they're like five times our wealth, but they don't have such an evolved engineering education infrastructure. And they're not good at English, so they don't kind of go abroad. They're best to go to Germany. So if you look at Turkey, they struggle to kind of tap Silicon Valley capital, Silicon Valley ideas, Silicon Valley expertise, whereas Indians are able to tap that easily. So over the last few years, it's very easy now to kind of start up something in Bangalore, quickly access the knowledge or capital in the Bay Area and kind of sometimes even migrate there and start up. So you've seen, for example, the Indian B2B unicorns, iCertis, Dhruva, Postman, Freshdesk. I mean, I could go on, InMobi. They started in India. They grew, and all the founders now are abroad. And because they kind of built global businesses. So this is an unfair advantage India has for a poor country. And the fact that there are 25 to 30 million fluent English speakers who could kind of work anywhere in the West, and of which about 1% maybe migrate every year, but many of them even come back to start up. So very fortunate in that regard. This is sort of our secret weapon.
A few of the names of the companies you just took have grown to become unicorns in 2020. As we speak, I can count at least a dozen odd Indian startups that crossed $1 billion in valuation. Mm-hmm. Now, as that happens, Sachit, we see that the Indian startup ecosystem is again flushed with capital, with investors, I believe, yet again getting into a FOMO stage. Surplus money is there and no dearth of investor interest. Mm-hmm. Do you see that there is a startup valuation bubble yet again in the making?
This is interesting, tricky territory. Yeah, so you're absolutely right. I think the root of all of this is easy money. And easy money, the main problem is that the amount of money that is getting pumped into the international economy, global economy, thanks to the Fed printing dollars to kind of pump up or like prime growth. All of that money is beginning to find its way into global capital flows into countries like India. Added to that is historically, so there are two things, there are two big trends. One is this particular trend that I spoke about, which is quantitative easing, or basically since the global financial crisis of 2008-09, the Fed has been printing money like this, not to, like tomorrow, right? Strangely, there's no inflation, but all of that is going to assets getting overvalued. Or at least assets getting priced higher and higher. On the other hand, a lot of the pension funds, as the West ages, a lot of the pension funds are beginning to struggle to meet decent returns. And they're finding out that the big outlier, the performer historically has been venture capital. So a lot of the funds, large funds which are exposed to venture capital, have given handsome returns. So as a result, a lot of the endowments, the foundations, the pension funds, the insurance companies are beginning to transfer money from public market into private market. Now, there are 200 billion funds, 500 billion funds. As even 1% there, kind of is a lot of money which is coming into the venture capital ecosystem. Now, as it comes into the venture capital ecosystem, some percentage has to come into India. And so you're seeing these two large global trends leading to more and more money in India and beginning to go after talented founders, passionate founders, etc. It's a trend that is there everywhere across. It's not unique to India. But yes, we're beginning to see that in India.
Is it too early to call it a bubble, or this is the time?
I think bubble is an extremely strong word. Bubble is when you feel that there is no link to any rationality. Whereas in the startup world, we've historically always said that valuation is actually a function of the amount of capital I want to invest and how much dilution. So if I'm going to put in $10 million and I need 10% equity, then the company has to be valued at $100 million. It's logical. So if it is 5 million and I need 10% equity, it's 50 million. So what happens is that valuation is a derived outcome in our business. Yes, it's important to the extent that the next person coming in has to look at this valuation and maybe give 2x of it or whatever. But valuation is largely a derived outcome. And unfortunately for us, it's not that we say this company is worth $1 billion. I mean, yes, there is a lot of science to it. We do look at revenue multiples. We do look at, for example, many other indicators. But at the early stage, it's very hard to say it's overvalued. It's really a function of the capital that's coming into it. As of now, I would say that there is no real worry If anything, the challenge is in public market stocks like Tesla. If you look at some of the Indian stock market, that seems like very richly valued. And I would like to understand what some of the reasons for that are. So Priyanka, I don't think I would agree to a bubble. Yes, I would agree that valuations have crept up and certain companies, it's looking richly valued. But to say that it's a bubble, I don't know. I'm probably not an expert. And I also worry about the stock market prices, which seem to be like, you know, I don't seem like not really able to understand what's happening out there. Yeah.
Okay. All right. On that note, Sachit, I would like to ask you one quick last question. If you were to choose three startups, and which is, of course, not a Bloom portfolio, which three would you say are promising startups in India and why?
Oh, wow. You've taken me. These can't be Bloom companies, is it? Bloom
no,
startups,
can't be
is
Bloom.
It?
Yes.
They can't be Bloom startups. Okay. So I would say I really like, are you okay if I pick slightly, or I'll pick a mix of large and small as well?
Absolutely.
In a very smallish kind of space, which is less than, I would say, maybe $10-15 million in valuation, I find there's a very interesting company called Pariksha in the startup space. They're not a Bloom portfolio. So they do test prep for India too. Policemen, Tehsildar, Subedar, and all kinds of exams, which I hadn't even heard of. So I find that a very interesting story of a company that's targeting, you know, aspirations of India too. Slightly larger is, for example, I find Khata Book quite interesting. Not just Khata Book, even OK Credit and all of these companies, Dukan. This entire retail tech, Dukan tech, Kirana tech space, I find particularly fascinating in terms of how they've been able to come up with products that go viral very fast. You know, in terms of how they've been able to hook to WhatsApp and how they've leveraged WhatsApp for growth. So that's another company, which is, again, not a Bloom portfolio company. And the third one I've always found interesting is, for example, Meesho, which has been able to kind of get women across India who are not necessarily affluent to kind of sell to their friends and have pioneered a very interesting e-commerce model, which is very unique to India, I would say. So you did take me by surprise, and perhaps I'm leaving out a lot of interesting and much liked companies, but I thought these three kind of give your listeners a flavor of very interesting entrepreneurial business models that are emerging out of India.
It absolutely does. All right, then, on that note, Sachit, I would really like to thank you for taking time out for us.
Thank you. Thank you, Priyanka. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
So that's all that we have for this episode of Setting Sail. Meanwhile, if you have any comments or queries, you can write down to us. Our email is mcpodcast@nw18.com. You can also follow us on Twitter with our user IDs @moneycontrol.com and @PriyankaSahai. Till then, for more news, views and updates, stay logged on to moneycontrol.com.